Our next speaker is Ismael Reyna. His topic is Latinos and the impact of globalization will have on the Hispanic paradox. Ismael Reyna is a Master's of Public Health student and candidate for 2014 at Chicago State University. He is the recipient of a Diversity for Faculty Initiative Fellowship from the Illinois Board of Higher Education 2013 and 2014. He recently was elected Student Board of Trustees Representative for the Student Government Association at Chicago State University. Also, he has applied to medical school for the 2014-15 year and is awaiting decision. At this time, I'd like to welcome our next speaker.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to and a privilege to be here on behalf of Chicago State. I extend my warmest hello. And so I had originally had about 30-something slides and thought we talked about it yesterday to make it brief, so I did, and had my own Hispanic paradox this morning when everything wiped off my computer, and I just literally got here. So I just want to give you... there's not a lot of slides that I get here, and I'm a better speaker than I am a PowerPoint pointer outer. So I was challenged by my professor, who is Dr. William Ebomoyi, to do something about the Latino paradox. And the Latino paradox is, as immigrants from, especially Mexicanos, as Mexicanos hold on to the culture, they come over here and they fare better against the white counterparts in infant mortality and outcomes. So, but as I started looking into globalization and the effects that it has on Mexico, I started uncovering several other disparities, which I'll briefly touch on. You know, one of them was the amount of corruption in Mexico that has led to the immigration wave coming here. And then now what's going on is that the fast food industry is now invading Mexico. And so now the Mexicanos and the Latinos that are populating Mexico and Latin America are starting to suffer from really dire consequences of obesity and diabetes and other chronic diseases. So there's a transition, a demographic transition, and an epidemiological transition that's going on, where now they're coming over here sicker, so the culture no longer is a protective effect for us. So with that, I'll just make progress, like we say back home, right? So I'm going to briefly define a couple of things about globalization. So it's the process that encourages worldwide communication and exchanges of goods and services, and still being able to maintain profitability for those countries that invest, right? Because it takes a community, some of the G8 nations maybe, and they come in and they invest, but it still has to be profitable so they don't lose money, right? And, you know, it interacts amongst countries of the world, and it develops their economy at the same time maintaining the ability to make money. It integrates economics, technology, economic, political, and cultural exchanges. And one of the outcomes that we're seeing is that as it's doing all of that, we can see the good effects about globalization is that people's salaries and wages are going up, but there is also a significant rift between those that have and those that have not, the haves and the haves not. And so we know that, we know in public health from our studies that that causes a lot of consequences, like access to healthcare or food. So, and that affects the choices that they make. So it does take credit for lifting millions of people out of poverty, and it also takes credit for increasing corruption, because people take advantage of the ability of globalization to offer them higher opportunities for investors and loosed trade agreements. Life expectancies are going up. Healthcare and educational opportunities are being improved. Incomes of low-skilled workers have risen, but their educational rates have not. So what we're seeing is, even though they are continuing to have higher salaries, they are not getting the education that they should. So it's also on the negative side, because globalization is pretty positive, but there are some negative effects. It has become responsible for outsourcing, deregulation of the economy, massive cutbacks in wages and labor, and this has led to a swarm of immigration. And so with immigration reform now, there's probably less likely It makes it a little harder for people that want to come over here not legally or without documents to get through. So the people that are highly educated in Latin America and in Mexico are coming through, but they are also the people that are starting to develop chronic diseases and diabetes and obesity because they can afford to have, fast food. And with fast food comes the fast life and the chronic diseases. So these are some of the trends that we have seen with globalization. And with that came an obesity epidemic. They're experiencing obesity rates similar or in some cases surpassing what we're seeing in the U.S. And I mean, let's just be honest about it. Fast food is not good for you. We all know that. It's probably not the popular thing to say, but that's not what public health is all about anyway. So they're moving from high complex carbohydrates and fibers towards diet high in lipids. And so these combinations are going to have increased in activity because Latinos are, we're not very active because we tend to think about, the culture tends to think that working is exercise, and it is not. So diets high in sugar, fat, saturated fat, salt, low in fruit, vegetables are major contributors to health problems, including all of the problems that we see in cancer. So what does this mean for the Hispanic-Latino paradox? Again, the Hispanic-Latino paradox says that people who have a strong culture, and I'm going to say that specifically Latinos, but Africans also see that. If you have a tight-knit culture, and you hold on to those good, positive things in your culture, then it will create a protective effect when you go into the United States and you have a fast track to, fast foods and also faster lifestyle. You know, we all experience that as grad students and having to work multiple jobs and eating on the run. So they're now starting again to get sicker and develop chronic diseases, and so that's starting to lower the rates for what we're seeing in the Latino paradox, better outcomes and infant mortality, even though they have a lower socioeconomic status, better rates of smoking for pregnant women. They don't smoke in the culture, it's kind of taboo, but as you melt in the pot for America, you start losing those cultural ties and values. And you're starting now to acculturate and give up the culture to the dominant culture, which says work, make money. And that's pretty much our American culture, right? Which is not bad, but there's a relationship there. So the reasons, like I was explaining, for the paradox are multifactorial and social in origin. There's a socio-cultural element to it, which if you come from Mexico and not Mexicano or Latino, and you come from Latin America, we tend to embrace those that are in our culture, and there's better health outcomes for people that are even not Latinos that live in Latin or Hispanic neighborhoods, as has been demonstrated in studies in Chicago. I'm from Chicago. So, in the area where there's a predominant Latino origin, African American, Caucasians, whatever, they have better outcomes because we tend to embrace that also. There's protective effects. We Latinos are also experiencing higher prevalence of obesity and type 2 diabetes in the United States. And the rise of incomes in Latin America, increase in fast food, fast-paced lifestyles will increase the likelihood that the immigrants that are coming here are already acculturated, assimilated. They already understand, the American lifestyle. So it's not anything new anymore. You're walking into this, and so you're already being assimilated. And also, one thing that I found interesting was that there's a trend for the second generation Latinos. Latinos born in the United States are more likely to engage in substance abuse and drug abuse. So we lose the benefits of the Latino paradox, also known as the epidemiological paradox, because of that. So, and the trend now is to see chronic. We went from infectious diseases in Latin America and Mexico to chronic diseases, due probably because of the vaccination. So on October 13th, Centers for Disease Control stated Hispanic population has a life expectancy of 2.5 years over non-Hispanic whites. We're also living longer, but with disease burden. And there's evidence of rising disease burden amongst Latinos, and that was done by the American Diabetes Association. And really what this means is You know, in 2050, we're projected to be the largest majority minority in the United States. So we're going to live in chronic disease. This impacts everybody. Everybody. I mean, one of the things I studied in public health my first semester last year was there's approximately 750,000 physicians in the United States. 20% of them speak Spanish. Okay, so you don't want to speak Spanish because it's America. Well, there's about $9 billion also of investment capital there that, you know, they're spending also. So it's a benefit for everybody, and it's a benefit to start learning how to be culturally sensitive and to speak to Latinos to not only eliminate this disparity, but also to go forward and increase our ability to help everybody else. So, you know, the rates are, you know, the economic impact of just diabetes itself is $174 billion. $54 billion of it is lost to productivity. And who works those jobs that everybody else doesn't? Well, Latinos, right? Latinos. So, and in 2010, there were 49.7 million people of Hispanic origin, 16% of the total population in the United States. And the intensity of the projections is that we will be 133 million in 2050. We're going to go from 12 to 24%. African Americans will stay at roughly about 13%. So it's a high projection. And actually, Asian Americans are going to do really well also. So with that being said, if the majority of the population, the minority population, will be Latinos, what are we supposed to do? And we're going to live in sickness. Here are some of the tables. I apologize for this. Again, I had my own Hispanic paradox, so I had to put everything in last minute, but it's okay. We're resourceful. So here are some of the numbers and projections. And here is another projection from Pascal and Cohn regarding Latinos and where we'll be. You know, 14% to 29%. And they roughly run from 12 to 24% or 12 to 30% is what their projections are. So just to bring this kind of closer to an end, what I'm saying is that the trend is that the westernized lifestyle, which is a high lipid fat diet and a high paced diet, which is increase your stress, and you want to talk about allostatic loads. So if more Latinos are becoming westernized in Latin America and in Mexico, I mean, just by default, we're going to have some problems. So here's what they're saying. We're going to have a threefold increase in diabetes prevalence. Sorry for the little mistake there. And we will be the single largest ethnic group in the United States. All of that adoption of a westernized lifestyle, I know, is not just terrible for Latinos, but it comes with unwanted daily stressors and insufficient exercise routines. So it's going to affect more than just Latinos. So what can we do? One of the things that I found interesting was in the UK, the last three bullets, empower local authorities to influence planning permission for food retail. So they got involved with, we're not going to let you advertise to the children, the consumers of pop soda, which we know is bad for you too. We're not going to let you put up fast food places around children because, you know, they're being groomed. And you know, eventually they will they're starting to develop more chronic diseases and illnesses and cancer at a younger stage of life because they don't know how to control that that tendency to consume. So they encouraged local planning authorities to restrict planning permission. I thought that was fantastic. I thought one of the great things I learned here at the APHA was how the mayor here eliminated soda pop and from the public buildings and from the children's schools. These are some of the things that we can implement. And last but not least, I guess I was scared of doing 30 slides and boring everybody. So I just really wanted to thank everybody at Chicago State, and I want to continue to thank everybody here today and at the APHA for the work that we do. And it's always been a really great experience to be here and to have been able to present to you and hear your presentations. And I encourage us all to just, if you have suggestions on how we can eliminate some of these disparities, all of them actually, I welcome it. You can contact me at any time. I'm an open door. And I just really want to thank everybody for their effort. And I definitely want to thank, the founders of the APHA and those that did public health prior to everything, and I think it's important to thank the past. I want to thank, right now I have a couple people from Chicago State. I want to thank Dr. Floyd Banks, because Dr. Floyd Banks was the chair of a biology department and hired me in 2010 and gave me an opportunity to survive school. And then I want to thank Dr. Thomas Britt, who just came in, who's our chair, and a wonderful, wonderful mentor. These are people that do public health every day, and thank you for the movement, and thank you for your time. And I'll take some questions in Spanish if you'd like. So, because again, I want to make sure that you all are ready for 2050. Hablas español y sería muy bonito contestar algunas preguntas. Si ustedes tienen cualquier cosa que quieren hablar o gusten hablar, estoy aquí a sus órdenes. So, all right. So, thank you so much.
At this time, we'll just open up questions. Yes.
So I have a question for you. For the last presentation, I was wondering, do you see any stark differences when you start disaggregating the Latino populations in terms of these trends that you've seen overall?
So do I see any trends, such as, you mean when they're no longer... So what I'm going to understand that as is, are you asking me when they're not in Latino populations?
No. So like you talked about Mexicans, right?
Yes.
Mexicano, and you talked about Latinos as a whole. Have you ever looked at it from a country of origin? Like if this person didn't come across?
Well, thank you. And what's your name?
Deborah,
I'm Ismael. Everybody usually just calls me Is. Thank you for that question. That's a really great question. So what I had found is that, you know, you look at all the paperwork, and I've been reading for about 5 months. So in Chile and in Argentina, you know, there's a tendency for different groups to have outcomes, but they're very similar. I read that part of the 5% of McDonald's overall income, and I'm not bad-mouthing them. I'm going to say it straight, right? I'm going to say it like I see it. And in Argentina, their 5% of McDonald's gross profits come from just that country. That's a lot. There's over 1,700 new fast food restaurants arising in Latin America. The poorest nations are the ones that are seeing it, like if you look in that Guatemala and Mexico. And this gets to something that I uncovered, is that globalization has allowed trade agreements to go into Mexico. And I'm from northern Mexico, from Monterrey, which we're seeing a large expansion of people. And just through some of my investigations on Facebook, using social media, I look at it and I ask my cousins, you know, how many fast food restaurants do you have that? Or where do you guys go? And it becomes a class, a symbol of class to the poor people. So they, you know, like Walmart, Sam's goes over there and invests a lot of money. And only a portion of some of those regions see that money. So the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, but some of those poor people are able to afford fast food now, and so there is where we're starting to see those trends, is where that gap is getting really big, because they're already affluent, you know. So, you know, I think 39% of the Mexican GDP was from the most affluent, and then less than 10% was from the poor. So the trends are, yes, overall everybody is getting sicker and getting these terrible chronic diseases like obesity and diabetes, but we are seeing it closer to the border of Mexico. Since Mexico constitutes the majority of immigrants coming through here, I think that it's showing that they're the dominant minority Latinos suffering from these things. But then again, that brings up the question and the need for more research. So I thank you for your question. Was that okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't know if I missed it or if you looked at it, but how has the resurgence of fast food restaurants had an impact on the traditional economy of Mexico or other places you looked at, especially the restaurant businesses?
I'm trying to look for it here. was a wonderful thing that I was not able to put down for just lack of time. I had my own Hispanic paradox getting here. Westernization. They wrote about Westernization and the impact that it's having, that it is known that as we are adopting a Westernized style over there, globalization has opened up the door and is being cited and referenced as the increased amounts of McDonald's and the Burger King orders. You know, over there it's a dollar for a Whopper, like $1.28. And they're really, you know, if you think about it like this, I'll say this. Mexico is very corrupted. It's a very deep concern of mine because family of mine has been affected by it. And I know we usually say, well, it doesn't matter how you feel about it, but it should. And so what we're seeing is that there are loose trade agreements and you could pretty much do as much as you want as long as it's profitable for those that are in power. So there are no limits in marketing. There are no stops from advertising to children. You know, it's soda pop and fast food. And so, I mean, we're just seeing an increased amount of it. There's over I believe it's 1,778 new fast food restaurants like McDonald's and all that, and then Chinese food. And I love Chinese food. So, and I think most of us probably do, but if you think about what we do in America is they take MSG out, right, because it's bad for us, but we know that that makes it taste good. Over there, they don't have that kind of regulation. So, you know, they're not as concerned about it. So the trend, Dr. Britt, and thank you for that question, is that it's getting worse, and there's pretty much, you know, a la carte, you know, or carte blanche. They're allowed to do whatever they want.
So the health outcome is getting worse.
What about
the economy?
I mean, it's... Well, I don't recall the numbers as far as the economics of it, because again, limited in the amount of what I was going to present. I went from 30 slides to 12. So, it's increasing wages, it's increasing salaries, it's increasing, the ability for those, you know, conglomerates to make money. But that's also a problem because there's no limits on them. Right? Anybody else?
Any other questions? I have a question for Amanda. When they were doing the HIV testing, when they were performing the HIV testing on the women in your sample, did they do swabs or actual blood draws?
It was from different sources, so it varied on the data.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned like transportation costs and how that impacted people's adherence to, was that to therapy or testing or in terms of transportation?
Yeah, it would have been to both. The transportation costs would have applied to both testing and to treatment. If they don't have community health workers, they do have to go to a clinic, the closest clinic to their area, which could be within, you know, just a few miles, but for others it may take, you know, most of a day to get there. So they would have to provide transportation for their initial appointment for testing. But then if they are doing treatment that requires multiple visits, then the cost would add up for that as well. Every time they have to return to the clinic, they would have to provide their own transportation that way.
How did the low wages impact?
I'm sorry?
How did their wages impact? What percentage of their wages were they contributing to their health care?
I don't have data on that. I'm sorry.
Any other questions?
Do you have a question? No, I was waiting at my colleague.
I think I might ask time one. You said one of the barriers with lack of time, were there any type of focus groups that helped your participants address how to schedule time or manage time to participate in your Goal for Health program?
So what I had said earlier was we felt that one of the barriers
Oh, you're referring to one of the barriers in the assessment that they had identified?
Lack of time, and they were late to the program. Was there any type of trying to get together, brainstorm on how to improve?
Well, when we advertised the classes, we helped them understand that it was just going to be 15 minutes long. As soon as they come into the field, there was a whiteboard describing the class and how long it was going to take. And most of the parents would usually just sit around and watch the kids practice and interact with each other. So we would go pull them from wherever they were and ask them to come to the classes. So in terms of parents that were coaching, I don't think there was much that we could do. We couldn't pull them from the coaching and ask them to come to the classes, or the parents who had to work. But for those who were available and weren't really doing anything with the time, we would pull them into the classes. Does that answer your question?
Do we have any more questions?
I think I have a general question.
Okay.
So I guess this question would be for everybody. So I'm a first year PhD student, and I've never actually done research, so I've been more involved in policy and legislation in my experience, but I'm looking to get more involved in research. So considering the fact that all of your students and that you all are making research, I'm curious, do you have any suggestions on how I could to kind of get more involved in research? You know, is there like a certain way that you did it over here to get involved in research?
Can I
answer that?
Sure. So I think that my suggestion is, and actually there's someone from my cohort, Dr. Delisha Kenny here, and then Dr. Epmoy and Dr. Yashika Watkins. And I think that the easiest way to go about it, or at least what has facilitated being able to do research, is that we have worked as a collective we all do it the same way. Chicago State University is a predominantly minority-based school. Our public health program focuses on all of the disparities with them. And so because of that, it is so easy to do research in several different areas and arenas. But we ask, most of the professors, all of the professors are very open. And I'm interested in doing rotational type of research, almost, because I do want to pursue medicine with public health. Every arena that all the professors are involved in, I try to do, as much as I can, at least one semester. And so I would definitely encourage you just to ask and follow them around, shadow them. Don't stalk them. Shadow them. But sometimes you need to do that too. So I would just say that I think that's the best way you can get. And this is a continuing mission that we're doing. So.
Any other suggestions from my other panelists? If we don't have any more questions, I want to thank everyone for coming out and supporting our students on the panel. And once again, I'll offer my deepest apologies that you missed the presentation. But thank you, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of your day and presentations, that you're here later.